This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Multipliers, revised and updated. How the best leaders make everyone smarter. Written and read by Liz Wiseman. With a foreword read by John Maher. This digital audiobook comes with a PDF containing appendices C, D, and E from the print edition. Please download the PDF for free from your audiobook provider.
Dedication. To my children, Megan, Amanda, Christian, and Joshua, who have taught me to lead and shown me why being a multiplier matters.
Foreword by Stephen R. Covey. I had the opportunity to work with a multiplier when I was in my early 20s. It profoundly shaped the rest of my life. I had decided to take a break in my education to provide extended volunteer service. The invitation came to go to England. Just 4.5 months after my arrival, the president of the organization came to me and said, "I have a new assignment for you. I want you to travel around the country and train local leaders." I was shocked. Who was I to train leaders in their 50s and 60s? Some of these individuals had been leading twice as long as I had been alive. Sensing my doubt, he simply looked me in the eye and said, "I have great confidence in you. You can do this. I will give you the materials to help you prepare to teach these leaders." It is hard to overstate the impact this leader had on me. By the time I returned home, I had begun to detect the work I wanted to devote my life to. His particular ability to get more out of people than they knew they had to give fascinated me. I have reflected on this many times, wondering what he did that got so much from me. The answer to this question is contained in this book. New Demands, Insufficient Resources. At a time when many organizations do not have the luxury of adding or transferring resources to tackle major challenges, they must find the capabilities within their current ranks. The ability to extract and multiply the intelligence that already exists in the organization is red-hot relevant. Across industries and organizations of all kinds, leaders now find themselves in what David Allen has summarized as new demands, insufficient resources. For some 40 years, I have worked with organizations that were grappling with new demands, insufficient resources. I have become convinced that the biggest leadership challenge of our times is not insufficient resources per se, but rather our inability to access the most valuable resources at our disposal. When I ask in my seminars, how many of you would agree that the vast majority of the workforce possesses far more capability, creativity, talent, initiative, and resourcefulness than their present jobs allow or even require them to use? The affirmative response is about 99%. Then I ask a second question. Who here feels the pressure to produce more from less? Again, a sea of hands goes up. When you put those two questions together, you can see the challenge. As stated in this book, indeed, people are often overworked and underutilized. Some corporations have made hiring the most intelligent individuals a core strategy on the basis that smarter people can solve problems more quickly than the competition. But that only works if the organizations can access that intelligence. Organizations that figure out how to better access this vastly underutilized resource won't just be more enjoyable places to work. They will outperform their competitors. In this global environment, this might well make the difference between companies that make it and those that don't. And as with so many business challenges, leadership is clearly a critical force for leveraging the full capability of the organization. The new idea. Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter, represents nothing less than the leadership paradigm necessary for accessing the intelligence and potential of people in organizations everywhere. It unearths and explains why some leaders create genius all around them, while other leaders drain intelligence and capability from an organization. Peter Drucker spoke of what is at stake when he wrote, "The most important and indeed the truly unique contribution of management in the 20th century was the 50-fold increase in the productivity of the manual worker in manufacturing. The most important contribution management needs to make in the 21st century is similarly to increase the productivity of knowledge work and the knowledge worker. The most valuable assets of the 20th century company were its production equipment. The most valuable asset of a 21st century institution, whether business or non-business, will be its knowledge workers and their productivity." This book explains with great clarity the kinds of leaders who will answer the promise outlined by Drucker and those who will not. As I read this book, a key insight was that multipliers are hard-edged managers. There is nothing soft about these leaders. They expect great things from their people and drive them to achieve extraordinary results. Another insight that resonated with me was that people actually get smarter and more capable around multipliers. That is, people don't just feel smarter, they actually become smarter. They can solve harder problems, adapt more quickly, and take more intelligent action. People who understand these ideas will be well positioned to make the shift the authors describe from genius, where they may try to be the smartest person in the room, to genius maker, where they use their intelligence to access and multiply the genius in others. The power of such a shift is difficult to overstate. It is a night and day difference. What I love about this book. I admire the work and insight in this book for several reasons. First, for the journalistic integrity and sheer tenacity required to analyze over 150 executives across the Americas, Europe, Asia, and Africa. The book is full of rich and vivid examples gathered from all over the world. Second, for the way this book focuses on just those few things that really differentiate intelligence multipliers and intelligence diminishers. This isn't a general book on leadership with all good qualities on one side and all bad qualities on the other. It is more precise than that, identifying and illustrating only the five most differentiated disciplines. Third, for the book's range of motion. This book names a phenomenon the way Malcolm Gladwell seems to be able to, but also goes down several layers to provide practical insight into exactly how to lead like a multiplier. Fourth, for the way the book seamlessly combines cutting-edge insight with timeless principles. Many books do one or the other, few do both. This book will relate to your life today, and it will connect to your conscience, too. An idea whose time has come. Liz Weissman and Greg McKeown have written a book that is relevant for the entire world. Corporate executives will immediately see its relevance, but so will leaders in education, hospitals, foundations, nonprofit organizations, entrepreneurial startups, healthcare systems, middle-sized businesses, and government at the local, state, and national level. I believe this book is relevant to everyone from first-time managers to world leaders. This book comes to the world at a time when it is greatly needed, a time of new demands, insufficient resources, when CFOs and HR directors are surprisingly in sync about the need for an approach that better leverages current resources. The principles in this book will always be true, but in this economic climate, they will win in the marketplace of ideas. Their relevance will give them life and attention that is deserved. These are ideas that matter now, and as Victor Hugo once said, there is nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. I have a vision of thousands of leaders discovering they have unintentionally diminished the people around them and taking steps toward becoming a multiplier. I have a vision of schools with diminishing cultures being reinvented around multiplier principles to the benefit of the whole community. I have a vision of world leaders learning how to better access the intelligence and capability of those they serve to address some of the world's toughest challenges. And so I challenge you to recognize the opportunity that is in your hands. Don't just read this book. Pay the price to really become a multiplier. Don't let this become a buzzword in your organization. Use the principles to reinvent your organization toward a true multiplying culture that gets more out of people than they knew they had to give. Choose to be a multiplier to people around you, as the president was to me in England all those years ago. I have great confidence in the good that can come from such an approach to leadership in your team and in your entire organization. Just imagine what would happen to our world if every leader on the planet took one step from diminisher to multiplier. It can be done.
Preface. This book began with a simple observation. There is more intelligence inside our organizations than we are using. It led to the idea that there was a type of leader, those I came to call multipliers, who saw, used, and grew the intelligence of others, while other leaders, whom I labeled diminishers, shut down the smarts of those around them. When the book was released in 2010, this idea struck a chord with managers around the world, perhaps because it came on the heels of a global recession, a time when a tectonic shift was occurring in management and the ground was moving under all our feet. What was once predictable and manageable had become volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. With the explosion of information, for example, doubling every 9 months in science and technology, there is simply too much for any one person to know. Consequently, the role of leader has shifted too, moving away from a model where the manager knows, directs, and tells, and toward one where the leader sees, provokes, asks, and unleashes the capabilities of others. Ideas that were once considered subversive are the new normal. Diminisher bosses still exist, but like old BlackBerry phones, it's only a matter of time before they become obsolete and people upgrade to newer models. As companies do the math, they realize that they simply can't afford leaders who waste talent, suppress vital innovation, and slow business growth. After all, why would a company pick results-driven leaders who diminish people when they could have leaders who both deliver results and grow people around them? Increasingly, we are seeing diminishing leaders being asked to adapt or leave. Consider the fate of Jorgen, a general manager for a large multinational pharmaceutical company. Jorgen was a classic diminisher who ran a country operation like a dictator and made life miserable for his direct reports. For years, his behavior was tolerated because he delivered results. But then the company underwent a significant restructuring to better respond to changes in the marketplace. Instead of a single person calling the shots from the top, they organized around dynamic teams that could span organizational boundaries. Jorgen, accustomed to being the boss, struggled to adapt to this non-autocratic approach. Several months later, Jorgen was called to the corporate office in Europe and told that his style of leadership wasn't working. Jorgen responded with a compelling presentation that detailed his unit's performance. The executive team stopped him and said, "This is purely a style issue. You can no longer be a leader here." Jorgen was removed from his role as general manager and moved into a lower-level staff role. His former direct reports celebrated when they heard the news, especially the one who was just days away from quitting. But Jorgen wasn't pushed out by staff mutiny. He was a casualty of circumstance. The business environment pushed his company out of the diminisher camp, and he was left behind. We are seeing more and more senior leaders left stunned in similar scenarios. While some organizations seek innovation and agility, others are struggling to do more with less. Matthew Hawes, assistant superintendent of the Albemarle County Public School District in Virginia, said, "We are just running so lean. I can't imagine a world where you could work in silos and not collaborate. You used to be able to isolate yourself, but now efficiency requires collaboration. When you think about what is best for the organization and remove your ego, being a multiplier is the only way to go." While the direction may be clear, we clearly aren't there yet. Gallup's State of the Global Workplace study finds that across 142 countries, only 13% of people around the world are fully engaged at work. Sherm reports that while 86% of Americans were happy with their jobs in 2009, that percentage has been in slow but steady decline ever since. This lack of engagement isn't just an emotional issue. It implies a waste in the fundamental resource that powers most companies today, intellectual capital. And in 2011, after assessing hundreds of executives, we found that managers were utilizing just 66% of their people's capability on average. In other words, by our analysis, the managers are paying a dollar for their resources, but extracting only 66 cents in capability, a 34% waste. When considering only their direct reports, that number increases to 72%. As we've tracked this indicator over the last 5 years, we've seen a slow, steady improvement, rising from 72% in 2011 to 76% in 2016. And while managers have become better at estimating their diminishing impact on others, most managers are still overestimating their multiplier characteristics. They believe that they are having an enabling, liberating effect on their team, but team members see things differently. We are improving. However, too many organizations are still overmanaged and underled. In realizing a richer way of working, many critical questions still remain. How fast can we get there? What is the best path to impact? Who can make the shift and who can't? What do we do with those who can't? How do we move and reshape an entire culture? As many authors will confess, the most important insights on a subject tend to come long after the book is written. This new edition incorporates what my colleagues and I have learned as we grappled with these questions and continue to teach and study pioneering companies and their leaders. Here are the three most essential insights that have shaped this new edition. Number one, the need is universal. In studying leadership, one learns a lot about followership. I've learned that people across cultures, across professions, across industries, come to work each day hoping to be well utilized, not by being given more and more work, but through the recognition that they're capable of contributing in significant ways and doing progressively more challenging work. The need for multiplier leadership spans industries and cultural boundaries. It's not just for innovation centers like Silicon Valley. It is as relevant in industries such as manufacturing, education, and healthcare, and in cities like Shanghai, Seoul, and Sao Paulo. In cultures with high levels of hierarchy, we still find the presence of multiplier leaders, but we find that the effects of diminishing leaders are more pronounced. The 2x difference between multipliers and diminishers becomes a 3x differential, with the average diminisher yielding roughly 30% of their employees' capability instead of the global average of 48%. And it's not just for millennials. Certainly new and younger workers expect, if not demand, to be treated differently than those who came before them. But I'm not convinced millennials actually need or want anything different than other corporate denizens. Contributors of all ages and stages want their ideas to matter, their voices to be heard, and workplaces where they can grow. Millennials have just been too impatient to wait, and too empowered by technology not to speak out. What's good for the millennials is good for the mainstream. Number two, sometimes the good guys are the bad guys. When I began this research, most diminishers appeared to be tyrannical, narcissistic bullies. But I've come to see that the vast majority of the diminishing happening inside of our workplaces is done with the best of intentions, by what I call the accidental diminisher, good people trying to be good managers. I've become less interested in knowing who is a diminisher and much more interested in understanding what provokes the diminisher tendencies that lurk inside each of us. Chapter 7, The Accidental Diminisher, is new and offers a glimpse into how our best intentions can go awry, and how, with self-awareness and simple workarounds, otherwise good managers can become great leaders. I've added this chapter because our greatest gains in the workplace will not come by reforming hardened diminishers, but by helping accidental diminishers become more intentional multipliers and increasing the number of multiplier moments in the workplace, perhaps raising their utilization of employee talent from the current average of 76% to the target 100%. Number 3, the biggest barriers are contextual and cultural. To build organizations where intelligence is richly utilized, we need both an offensive and defensive plan. Most leaders who read the book aspire to lead like multipliers and find the better angels of their nature, as Abraham Lincoln once said. However, their efforts are stymied because too much of their mental energy is spent dealing with the devils around them. For others, their diminishing colleagues leave them so enervated that their will to lead excellently is weakened as well. To understand how to counter the effects of short-sighted, absent-minded diminishers, I surveyed hundreds of professionals and interviewed dozens more. I've learned that the reductive effect of a diminisher is not inevitable. While you cannot change another person, you can change your response and smooth the sharp edges of your diminishing boss or colleague. Chapter 8, Dealing with Diminishers, offers strategies and tactics to help reverse the cycle of diminishing or at least minimize its effects. Unlocking individual potential is not just a matter of personal will and individual behavior change. It is a function of entire systems, and reshaping collective will is hard work. To help you navigate the complexities of large-scale change, my team at the Wiseman Group and I have studied organizations that are successfully making this shift. Chapter 9, Becoming a Multiplier, illuminates the paths that help entire organizations overcome inertia and move from insight to impact. This new edition also contains some additional resources. There are new multiplier examples from all around the world, and Appendix E, in the included PDF, is a set of experiments to help you develop multiplier mindsets and practices. Also, the frequently asked questions in Appendix B have been expanded and now address the hardest-hitting questions that I've been asked by thousands of readers. These questions include, what about leading in times of crisis? What about iconic leaders like Steve Jobs with strong diminishing streaks? And more. Our world is rapidly changing. To keep up and to create the type of workplaces where people thrive, we need diminishing leaders to be replaced by those who serve as true multipliers, inspiring collective intelligence and capability on a mass scale. It's immense, both in promise and deed, so let's begin. Liz Wiseman, Menlo Park, California, 2017. Chapter 1, The Multiplier Effect. It has been said that after meeting with the great British Prime Minister, William Ewart Gladstone, you left feeling he was the smartest person in the world. But after meeting with his rival, Benjamin Disraeli, you left thinking you were the smartest person. Bono. During the summer of 1994, Derek Jones joined the U.S. Navy to escape his decaying hometown of Detroit, Michigan. Derek, a street-smart, confident 18-year-old, scored high on the Navy's aptitude exam and was slotted to enter its advanced electronics computer program. Following 9 weeks of boot camp in Illinois and 8 months of intense training on missile firing systems, Derek earned advancement to Petty Officer Third Class and was selected for advanced training as an Aegis computer network technician. He graduated first in his class and in recognition was able to choose the ship that he would serve on. He picked the Navy's newest, Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyer. Within months, he had established himself among the 210 enlisted men as a superior performer and was recognized by his officers as one of the ship's smartest and hardest-working sailors. On the verge of earning a critical qualification, Derek felt on top of his game. That is, until a new commanding officer, CO, Commander Fredericks, took the helm. Fredericks was a graduate of the United States Naval Academy, and his assignment as captain of this Arleigh Burke destroyer put him in an elite class of officers being groomed for cruiser command. Accepting a major mistake, he was on track to become an admiral. Fredericks had superior knowledge of the ship's operations, which he flaunted to his sailors. He managed even the most minute details of the ship's operations, every situation, and every sailor. In preparation for the ship's first missile exercise under Frederick's command, Derek's team was to ensure that the ship's weapon systems were 100% available. A few days before the exercise, Derek and his peers realized that the ship was missing a critical part, so the sailors secured it through an informal network, then repaired the system, and returned it to full operation. Several days later, Fredericks learned of this episode from the CO of a sister ship, who mentioned in passing that his sailors had provided the part. Instead of being pleased that the young sailors had shown initiative and resourcefulness, Commander Fredericks, evidently embarrassed that his ship required assistance, was livid. Derek instantly became the target of Fredericks' wrath and elevated scrutiny. During a typical missile exercise, the CO and the ship's tactical action officer, TAO, survey the battlefield, find the enemy, determine a firing solution, aim, shoot, and hit the target, all in rapid succession and while being engaged by the enemy. Hundreds of things happen at once that must be processed, prioritized, decided, and then acted upon. Success requires intense concentration and keen mental aptitude. These operations can be particularly intimidating because the commanding officer may be standing inches from the Aegis operator, watching every decision and taking constant notes. Derek and his team now perform these operations under the wary eye of Fredericks, who publicly mocked their efforts when they failed to immediately determine firing solutions for assigned targets. In the end, Derek didn't just perform poorly in one training evolution, he failed nearly every scenario. He had been stellar in the classroom and during team training, but as Fredericks loomed over his shoulder, managed every detail, and found every mistake, the tension mounted. Derek couldn't think properly and struggled to perform. As the scrutiny continued, Derek and his team became less and less capable. Within weeks, Derek and his chief petty officers were convinced they couldn't operate the ship's combat systems without the CO's intervention. The failure was so clear that Fredericks revoked Derek's qualification to operate the Aegis console. After that, Derek's performance on the ship fell into a tailspin. This downturn was interrupted only 3 months later when the ship received a new CO. Commander Abbott was also a Naval Academy graduate and was as confident in his sailors as he was in his own abilities. Abbott had worked previously for a high-ranking defense official who assigned him projects stretching him to the limits of his ability. Having been briefed of Derek's troubles with the previous CO, Abbott quickly sought Derek out and informed him that they would be taking the ship to sea for another missile exercise before an extended deployment, saying, "Jones, you are my man in this exercise. Make sure we're ready to ace this test. I'm counting on you, and so are your shipmates." For a week, Derek's teams flawlessly exercised the Aegis systems in every scenario. As they prepared, the new CO provided a watchful eye and was calm and inquisitive. Derek no longer felt like he was being tested, but rather that he was learning and working with the CO on a challenge. On the day of the exercise, the new CO standing behind him, Derek operated the Aegis console and provided the correct solutions time after time without error, achieving the highest score any ship had seen in over a year. Commander Abbott announced on the ship's speaker system, "Petty Officer Jones and crew won the battle for us today." Derek continued to advance on the ship. He was made Petty Officer Second Class in record time and became the ship's Sailor of the Quarter, a high honor. Abbott placed Derek in the top 5% of the crew and nominated him for the STAY 21, or Seaman to Admiral program, where he would earn his college degree and a commission as a naval officer. Upon completing officer training, Derek was promoted each time his record was reviewed. In less than 9 years, he was selected to become an executive officer, training and cultivating other officers. Today, he serves in the U.S. Navy as a lieutenant commander and is destined for success as a commanding officer. Derek's Navy experience illustrates that a change in command can often cause a change in capability. He was stupefied with fear under one leader, but smart and capable under another. What did Frederick say and do that so diminished Derek's intelligence and capability? And what did Abbott do that restored and expanded Derek's ability to reason and navigate complexity? Some leaders make us better and smarter. They bring out our intelligence. This book is about these leaders who access and revitalize the intelligence in the people around them. I call them multipliers. This book will show you why they create genius around them and make everyone smarter and more capable. Questioning genius. There are bird watchers and there are whale watchers. I'm a genius watcher. I am fascinated by the intelligence of others. I notice it, study it, and have learned to identify a variety of types of intelligence. Oracle Corporation, the software giant worth $174 billion, was a great place for genius watching. In the 17 years I worked in senior management at Oracle, I was fortunate to work alongside many intelligent executives, all systematically recruited from the best companies and the elite universities as top performers. Because I worked as the vice president responsible for the company's global talent development strategy and ran the corporate university, I worked closely with these executives and had a front row seat to study their leadership. From this vantage point, I began to observe how they used their intelligence in very different ways, and I became intrigued by the effect that they had on the people in their organizations. The problem with genius. Some leaders seem to drain intelligence and capability out of the people around them. Their focus on their own intelligence and their resolve to be the smartest person in the room had a diminishing effect on everyone else. For them to look smart, other people had to end up looking dumb. We've all worked with these black holes. They create a vortex that sucks energy out of everyone and everything around them. When they walk into a room, the shared IQ drops and the length of the meeting doubles. In countless settings, these leaders were idea killers and energy destroyers. Other people's ideas suffocated and died in their presence, and the flow of intelligence came to an abrupt halt around them. Around these leaders, intelligence flowed only one way, from them to others. Other leaders used their intelligence as a tool rather than a weapon. They applied their intelligence to amplify the smarts and capability of people around them. People got smarter and better in their presence. Ideas grew, challenges were surmounted, hard problems were solved. When these leaders walked into a room, light bulbs started switching on over people's heads. Ideas flew so fast that you had to replay the meeting in slow motion just to see what was going on. Meetings with them were idea mashup sessions. These leaders seemed to make everyone around them better and more capable. These leaders weren't just intelligent themselves, they were intelligence multipliers. Perhaps these leaders understood that the person sitting at the apex of the intelligence hierarchy is the genius maker, not the genius. Post-Oracle therapy. The idea for this book emerged from my post-Oracle therapy. Leaving Oracle was like stepping off a high-speed bullet train and suddenly finding everything moving in slow motion. This sudden calm created space for me to ponder about the lingering question. How do some leaders create intelligence around them while others diminish it? As I began teaching and coaching executives, I saw the same dynamic playing out in other companies. Some leaders seemed to boost the collective IQ, while others sucked the mental life out of their employees. I found myself working with highly intelligent executives who were struggling with their own tendency to either overtly or subtly shut down the people around them. I also worked with many senior leaders struggling to make better use of their resources. Most of these leaders had developed their leadership skills during times of growth. However, in a more austere business climate, they found themselves unable to solve problems by simply throwing more resources at them. They needed to find ways to boost the productivity of the people they already had. I recall one particularly pivotal conversation with a client named Dennis Moore, a senior executive with a genius-level IQ. As we discussed how leaders can have an infectious effect on the intelligence in their organization and spark a viral intelligence, he responded, "These leaders are like amplifiers. They're intelligence amplifiers." Yes, certain leaders amplify intelligence. These leaders, whom we have come to call multipliers, create collective viral intelligence in organizations. Other leaders act as diminishers and deplete the organization of crucial intelligence and capability. But what is it that these multipliers do? And what do multipliers do differently than diminishers? Scouring business school journals and the internet looking for answers to these questions, as well as resources for clients, yielded only frustration. This void set the course for my research into this phenomenon. I was determined to find answers for leaders wanting to multiply the intelligence of their organizations. The research. The first major discovery was finding my research partner, Greg McEwen, who was studying at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. Greg has a curious and tenacious mind and a passion for leadership that gave him my same measure of determination to find the answers. We began our formal research by defining the question that would consume us for the next 2 years. What are the vital few differences between intelligence diminishers and intelligence multipliers? And what impact do they have on organizations? Waking up for 730 days with the same question was like the movie Groundhog Day, in which Bill Murray wakes each day to the same time and song on his alarm clock, destined to repeat the events of the previous day. In the singular and prolonged pursuit of this question, we developed a deep understanding of the multiplier effect. We began our research by selecting a set of companies and industries in which individual and organizational intelligence provide a competitive advantage. Because these organizations rise or fall based on the strength of their intellectual assets, we assumed the multiplier effect would be pronounced. We interviewed senior professionals inside these organizations, asking them to identify two leaders, one who fit the description of a multiplier and one a diminisher. We studied more than 150 of the resulting leaders through interviews and a quantitative assessment of their leadership practices. For many leaders, we then followed an intensive 360-degree interview process with both former and current members of their management teams. As our research expanded, we studied additional leaders from other companies and industries, looking for common elements that spanned the business and nonprofit sectors, as well as geographies. Our research journey took us across four different continents and introduced us to an incredibly rich and diverse set of leaders. We came to know some of these leaders quite well, studying them and their organizations in depth. Two of the leaders we studied provided a sharp contrast between these two leadership styles. They both worked for the same company and in the same role. One had the Midas touch of a multiplier, and the other had the chilling effect of a diminisher. A Tale of Two Managers. Vikram worked as an engineering manager under two different division managers at Intel. Each leader could be considered a genius. Both had a profound impact on Vikram. The first leader was George Schneer, a division manager for one of Intel's businesses. Manager number one, the genius maker. George had a reputation for running successful businesses at Intel. Every business he ran was profitable and grew under his leadership. But what most distinguished George was the impact he had on the people around him. Vikram said, "I was a rock star around George. He made me. Because of him, I transitioned from an individual contributor to a big-time manager. Around him, I felt like a smart SOB. Everyone felt like that. He got 100% for me. It was exhilarating." The rest of George's team echoed the same sentiments. We are not sure exactly what George did, but we knew we were smart and we were winning. Being on this team was the highlight of our careers. George grew people's intelligence by engaging it. He wasn't the center of attention and didn't worry about how smart he looked. What George worried about was extracting the smarts and the maximum effort from each member of his team. In a typical meeting, he spoke only about 10% of the time, mostly just to crisp up the problem statement. He would then back away and give his team the space to figure out an answer. Often the ideas his team would generate were worth millions. George's team drove the business to achieve outstanding revenue growth and to deliver the profit bridge that allowed Intel to enter the microprocessor business. Manager number two, the genius. Several years later, Vikram moved out of George's group and went to work for a second division manager who had been the architect of one of the early microprocessors. This second manager was a brilliant scientist who had now been promoted into management to run the plant that produced the chips. He was highly intelligent by every measure and left his mark on everyone and everything around him. The problem was that this leader did all the thinking. Vikram said he was very, very smart, but people had a way of shutting down around him. He just killed our ideas. In a typical team meeting, he did about 30% of the talking and left little space for others. He gave a lot of feedback. Most of it was about how bad our ideas were. This manager made all the decisions himself, or with a single confidant. He would then announce those decisions to the organization. Vikram said, "You always knew he would have an answer for everything. He had really strong opinions and put his energy into selling his ideas to others and convincing them to execute on the details. No one else's opinions mattered." This manager hired intelligent people, but they soon realized that they did not have permission to think for themselves. Eventually, they would quit or threaten to quit. Ultimately, Intel hired a second-in-command to work alongside this manager to counter the intelligence drain on the organization. But even then, Vikram said, "My job was more like cranking than creating. He really only got from me about 50% of what I had to offer, and I would never work for him again." Diminisher or multiplier? The second leader was so absorbed in his own intelligence that he stifled others and diluted the organization's crucial intelligence and capability. George bred out the intelligence in others and created collective viral intelligence in his organization. One leader was a genius. The other was a genius maker. It isn't how much you know that matters. What matters is how much access you have to what other people know. It isn't just how intelligent your team members are. It's how much of that intelligence you can draw out and put to use. We've all experienced these two types of leaders. What type of leader are you right now? Are you a genius or are you a genius maker? The multiplier effect. Multipliers are genius makers. What we mean by that is that they make everyone around them smarter and more capable. Multipliers invoke each person's unique intelligence and create an atmosphere of genius, innovation, productive effort, and collective intelligence. In studying multipliers and diminishers, we learned that at the most fundamental level, they get dramatically different results from their people. They hold a different logic and set of assumptions about people's intelligence, and they do a small number of things very differently. Let's first examine the impact of the multiplier effect. Why do people get smarter and more capable around multipliers? And how do they get twice as much from their resources as do the diminishers? Multipliers get more from their people because they are leaders who look beyond their own genius and focus their energy on extracting and extending the genius of others. And they don't just get a little more back, they get vastly more. 2X multiplier effect. The impact of a multiplier can be seen in two ways. First, from the point of view of the people they work with. And second, from the point of view of the organizations they shape and create. Let's begin by examining how multipliers influence the people who work around them. Extracting intelligence. Multipliers extract all of the capability from people. In our interviews, people told us that multipliers got a lot more out of them than diminishers. We asked each person to identify the percentage of their capability that a diminisher received from them. The numbers typically ranged between 20 and 50%. When we asked them to identify the percentage of their capability that the multiplier extracted, the numbers typically fell between 70 and 100%. When we compared the two sets of data, we were amazed to find that multipliers got 1.97 times more. That represents an almost twofold increase, a 2X effect, or two times. After conducting our formal research, we continued to pose this question in workshops and with management teams, asking people to reflect on their past multiplier and diminisher bosses. Across industries and in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, we continued to find that multipliers get at least two times more from people. What could you accomplish if you could get twice as much from your people? The reason for the difference is that when people work for multipliers, they hold nothing back. They offer the very best of their thinking, creativity, and ideas. They give more than the jobs require and volunteer their discretionary effort, energy, and resourcefulness. They actively search for more valuable ways to contribute. They hold themselves to the highest standards. They give 100% of their abilities to the work, and then some. Extending intelligence. Not only do multipliers extract capability and intelligence from people, they do it in a way that extends and grows that intelligence. In interviews, people often said multipliers accessed more than 100% of their capability. Initially, I pushed back when they would say, oh, they got 120% from me, pointing out that getting more than 100% is mathematically impossible. But we continued to hear people claim multipliers got more than 100% from them. And we began to ask, why would people insist that intelligence multipliers got more out of them than they actually had. Our research confirmed that multipliers not only access people's current capability, they stretch it. They get more from people than they knew they had to give. People reported actually getting smarter around multipliers. The implication of our research is that intelligence itself can grow. This is an insight that is corroborated by other recent research into the extensible nature of intelligence. Consider a few studies. Carol Dweck of Stanford University has conducted groundbreaking research showing that children giving a series of progressively harder puzzles and praised for their intelligence stagnate for fear of reaching the limit of their intelligence. Children given the same series of puzzles, but then praised for their hard work, actually increase their ability to reason and to solve problems. When these children were recognized for their efforts to think, they created a belief and then a reality that intelligence grows. Eric Turkheimer of the University of Virginia has found that bad environments suppress children's IQs. When poor children were adopted into upper middle class households, their IQs rose 12 to 18 points. Richard Nisbet of the University of Michigan has reviewed studies that show 1, students' IQ levels drop over summer vacation, and 2, IQ levels across society have steadily increased over time. The average IQ of people in 1917 would amount to a mere 73 on today's IQ test. After reading these studies, I recalculated the data from our research interviews at face value, using the literal percentage of capability that people claimed multipliers received from them. When factoring this excess capability, the amount beyond 100%, into our calculations, we found that multipliers actually get 2.1 times more than diminishers. What if you not only got 2 times more from your team, everything they had to give, plus a 5 to 10% growth bonus because they were getting smarter and more capable while working for you? This 2x effect is a result of the deep leverage multipliers get from their resources. When you extrapolate the 2x multiplier effect to the organization, you begin to see the strategic relevance. Simply said, resource leverage creates competitive advantage. Resource leverage. Let's take the example of Tim Cook, currently CEO of Apple Inc. When Tim was COO and opened a budget review in one sales division, he reminded the management team that the strategic imperative was revenue growth. Everyone expected this, but they were astounded when he asked for the growth without providing additional headcount. The sales executive at the meeting said he thought the revenue target was attainable, but only with more headcount. He suggested they follow a proven linear model of incremental headcount growth, insisting that everyone knows that more revenue means you need more headcount. The two executives continued the conversation for months, never fully able to bridge their logic. The sales executive was speaking the language of addition, that is, higher growth by adding more resources. Tim was speaking the language of multiplication, that is, higher growth by better utilizing the resources that already exist. The logic of addition. This is the dominant logic that has existed in corporate planning, that resources will be added when new requests are made. Senior executives ask for more output, and the next layer of operational leaders request more headcount. The negotiations go back and forth until everyone settles on a scenario such as 20% more output with 5% more resources. Neither the senior executive nor the operational leaders are satisfied. Operational leaders entrenched in the logic of resource allocation and addition argue, 1, our people are overworked. 2, our best people are the most maxed out. And 3, therefore, Accomplishing a bigger task requires the addition of more resources. This is the logic of addition. It seems persuasive, but importantly, it ignores the opportunity to more deeply leverage existing resources. The logic of addition creates a scenario in which people become both overworked and underutilized. To argue for allocation without giving attention to resource leverage is an expensive corporate norm. Business school professors and strategy gurus Gary Hamel and C.K. Prahalad have written, "The resource allocation task of top management has received too much attention when compared to the task of resource leverage. If top management devotes more effort to assessing the strategic feasibility of projects in its allocation role than it does to the task of multiplying resource effectiveness, its value added will be modest indeed." Picture children at a buffet line. They load up on food, but a lot of it is left on the plate uneaten. The food gets picked at and pushed around, but it is left to go to waste. Like these children, diminishers are eager to load up on resources, and they might even get the job done, but many people are left unused, their capability wasted. Consider the costs of one high-flying product development executive at a technology firm. The high-cost diminisher. Jasper Wallace talked a good game. He was smart and could articulate a compelling vision for his products and their transformational benefits for customers. Jasper was also politically savvy, and he knew how to play politics. The problem was that Jasper's organization could not execute and realize the promise of his vision because they were in a perpetual spin cycle, spinning around him. Jasper was a strategist and an idea man. However, his brain worked faster and produced more ideas than his organization could execute. Every week or so, he would launch a new focus or a new initiative. His director of operations recalled, "He'd tell us on Monday we'd need to catch up with competitor X, and we needed to get it done this week." The organization would scurry, throw a Hail Mary pass, make progress for a few days, but eventually lose traction when they were given a new goal to chase the following week. This leader was so heavily involved in the details that he became a bottleneck in the organization. He worked extremely hard, but his organization moved slowly. His need to micromanage limited what the rest of the organization could contribute. His need to put his personal stamp on everything wasted resources and meant his division of 1,000 was only operating at about 500 strong. Jasper's modus operandi was to compete for resources with a larger division in the company that produced similar technology. Jasper's overriding goal was to outsize the other division. He hired people at a breakneck pace and built his own internal infrastructure and staff, all of which was redundant with existing infrastructure in the other division. He even convinced the company to build a dedicated office tower for his division. Things eventually caught up with Jasper. It became clear that his products were hype and the company was losing market share. When the real return on investment, ROI, calculation was made, he was removed from the company, and his division was folded into the other product group. The duplicate infrastructure he built was eventually removed, but only after many millions of dollars had been wasted and opportunities lost in the market. Diminishers come at a high cost. The logic of multiplication. We've examined the logic of addition and the resource inefficiencies that follow from it. Better leverage and utilization of resources at the organizational level require adopting a new corporate logic based on multiplication. Instead of achieving linear growth by adding new resources, leaders rooted in the logic of multiplication believe that you can more efficiently extract the capability of your people and watch growth skyrocket by multiplying the power of the resources you have. Here's the logic behind multiplication. Number one, Most people and organizations are underutilized. Number two, all capability can be leveraged with the right kind of leadership. Number three, therefore, intelligence